Is political correctness taking over education reform? Could it be the reason that things seem to be stalling? Not as many people, families getting the critical options they need in schooling? Enough support? Could it be that education reform funders are actually focused more on whether you're blue than whether you can help someone? That seems to be the conclusion of this breaking report, Education Reform's Deep Blue Hue, which my guests Rick Hess and Jay Green sat down to talk to me about. Take a listen.
And since all of the major funders in this space, I think, tend to sympathize with the people with the progressive talking points, what you have seen is the national professional organizations looking increasingly blue, even as the dynamics are very different in states and communities.
Welcome to Reality Check, a weekly podcast about anything and everything having to do with education. I'm Jeannie Allen, founder and CEO of the Center for Education Reform. We chose the name Reality Check because a lot of what you read about education these days is often wrong or misleading. If you want to know what's really going on in American education, from K through career, you're going to need a reality check. Welcome to this special newsmaker edition of Reality Check. I am so pleased to be joined today by my guests and friends, Rick Hess and Jay Green. Rick and Jay are both well-known thought leaders in the education reform movement. Rick is the Director of Education Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, and Jay is Distinguished Professor of Education Policy at the University of Arkansas. Last week, they jointly published a bombshell study, Education Reform's Deep Blue Hue, that received a lot of attention. It was published in Education Next. They compared ed reform's political composition to liberal Hollywood and academia, and arguing that contrary to popular belief, education reformers in America by and large identify not as centrists or even conservatives, but as Democrats. Rick and Jay, welcome to the show, but what the heck is this all about?
Well, I think it's something that actually we and many other people have actually been commenting on for a number of years, and we thought it might be useful to put some numbers to it to see if we could get people to address what we think is a basic fact about the set of people who are paid to work full-time on altering the arrangements for schools. We think that set of people is much more to the left, is more clearly Democratic in composition than some people are willing to acknowledge. And we thought that if we could systematically examine that, we might be able to demonstrate it in a way that would be convincing.
So I found this particular quote interesting. An open question is whether foundation giving has helped fuel reform's partisan tilt or is a reflection of it. The answer may shed light on the dynamics of educational philanthropy and perhaps on why so many of its efforts have encountered rough sailing. What does that mean exactly?
So a couple things. I mean, I think one, as Jay noted, what we studied, what we looked at in the study, is the large professional school reform organizations funded by the Gates Foundation and the Walton Foundation. Jeannie, you were commenting last week, noting that, hey, wait a minute, there's a lot of grassroots parents who are much more politically heterogeneous. And I think that's right. Jay and I were studying these big professionalized organizations. And when we look at this and we see that among the Gates Foundation grantees, 99% of political contributions are going to Democrats. Among Walton grantees, 87% of political contributions are going to Democrats. It raises the question of, wait a minute, is it that Gates and Walton are funding all of the major organizations in the field and that the fact that this leans so left is simply a reflection of what's out there? Is it the case that these foundations have perhaps cultivated or sought to invest in organizations that lean left for strategic reasons or because of relationships? And so what we acknowledge there and what you just read is we have no idea what the answer is. But we do think that if folks who spend a lot of time and effort studying education reform are, you interested in unearthing insights rather than scoring points, that these are big questions that deserve to be tackled.
You know, what's might be even more provocative, and I'm not intentionally doing so, than even this conversation so far, was calling out, which I did a little bit last week, but I know that you've definitely been sparring with a lot more people on this, whether these are even education reform groups. I mean, how do you define these groups as ed reform? I guess that's one of the questions I would have. I mean, I look at Gates grantees, Achieve. Okay, they were for standards. They weren't for educational freedom. Teach for America used to be that everyone who went to work for Teach for America, most of the teachers were really focused on making sure kids weren't zoned by zip code. But increasingly, Teach for America folks are anti-charter. And I just look at all these Turnaround for Children bellwether. Are they ed reform groups, or does Gates and Walton think they're ed reform groups?
So I think education reform is what the people who pay for it say it is. Right. So I think that's actually part of the issue here is Jeannie, you seem to be defining education reform as people advocating for greater educational freedom. And then that's one conception of reform. And I actually think that given the current political composition of those who work in education reform, that really is not their definition or their priority. And I think that's been clear in practice, and I think this research helps make that clear as well.
Right. So they, you're right, educational opportunity freedom is one aspect. So is devolving power to people closest to kids, right? You talk about in the report is teacher performance and teacher pay conservative. And you kind of go, nah, not really.
Oh, that was, I think that was me and Ed Week saying, that, right, a lot of assumptions have been made about, one of the things Jay and I have laughed about in anticipating response to the report is I think a lot of assumptions have been made that, look, Republicans and conservatives are there for school reform. So the real trick is to try to get enough Democrats. Except I think that has fundamentally represents a fundamental miscalculation about how a lot of responsible, conservative, and kind of centrist parents and families and communities think about this. People say Republicans and conservatives like testing. I'm like, wait a minute. I know conservatives who want schools to be accountable, that they're serving children well and spending money responsibly, but a lot of conservatives worry that folks in state capitals or Washington are going to start mucking about in their schools and invading kids' privacy in the name of grad schemes. I know a lot of conservatives who want teachers to be responsible professionals, but I don't know a lot of conservatives who are a big fans of state government getting into one-size-fits-all job descriptions and then trying to score employees across communities. So I think part of what's going on here is people have characterized these ideas as quote-unquote conservative, and therefore, they figured the real challenge is to try to recruit enough people on the left to say nice things about them. And what we've seen along the way is that the coloration and substance of what we understand reform to be is, I think, fundamentally morphed over the past 10 or 15 years.
Well, and it's interesting, you guys have talked a lot about this, and it seems that this parallels with what we've all seen as this over-regulation, re-regulatory reload of education reform. When we talked, and Jay, you'd participated in that event we did a while ago, and I called it isomorphism, but this whole notion that the longer we're around, the less we seem to be making progress. And so is that part of what's at the heart of this?
Well, I think there is a frustrating stall that has been afflicting people trying to improve quality of education. And we're trying to shed some light, provide some facts that might inform our discussion about why we've hit this stall and whether there's anything we can or should do about it. Now, it's also, I think, fine with us if people don't want to do something about it. We're really just trying to inform that discussion with some facts. And it's been striking to me that for an evidence-based decision-making field, there's been a little bit of resistance to some basic facts.
Right, right. That's interesting. And now I understand the purpose and also the context of your study more. I mean, for listeners, I just need to also emphasize that Rick Hess and Jay Green, in the field of academia, are actually among the most in touch with what's going on. So a lot of folks will pontificate and then walk away. You guys actually talk to groups. You have huge followings on Twitter and social media. You go out and talk to people in communities. Jay, you're like in the real world in Arkansas. Rick, sometimes you get out to the real world. But I say that because I think you know that also when I was kind of challenging you a little bit, and some of the discussions that I'm involved mostly in are at the very local level, whether it's in, you know, Phoenix and they're fighting over the development of new schools, or grassroots parent groups trying to bring back penmanship. And they don't actually call themselves anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they tend to support and side with people who are more likely to recognize their rights versus the blob, which tend to be more Republican. But at the state and local level, I see this much more centrist, if not leaning right, in the number of people who will do things. Now, does that mean Kentucky, which is all red, and Governor Bevin is doing everything he should? No. But the point is, I guess, is this an issue, the fact that these groups don't really recognize who's at the local level doing what?
So I think that's a great question. And what, you know, the way I tend to think about this is, look, you know, Jeannie, you were doing this before Jay and I were doing this. But thanks for the age comment,
Rick.
Yeah. And yet you're still so young. So what are you gonna, look, when I got on this stuff 20 years ago, it seemed, right, every movement has litmus tests. If you don't have a litmus test, you're not a movement. But it seemed to me that the movement, both locally and nationally, was, look, you had to think schools could do a lot better. You had to be open to talk of how to hold schools and educators responsible for doing good work. And you had to be comfortable with ideas of choice and educational freedom. And if you were comfortable with that, you could be in the reform camp. And I think what's changed over time, and we've seen this change at the national level much more than at the local level. At the local level, you still have reasonable people who are worried about what makes sense for their communities, doing things across lines. Nationally, though, what you see is, in order to be considered a reformer in good standing, you have to hate Trump. You have to sign on to Obama's disciplinary school guidance. You have to call for increased federal spend. There is a whole litany of very specific issues touching on things like immigration and federal spending and politics that those advocates would say they would say they're not bringing social issues to education. They would say that doing right by children requires being morally correct on these other issues. But what they have done is, because they are so ideologically loaded on these other issues, is they have forced those of us who disagree to either bite our tongues and work with people who ridicule the things that we believe in, or they have told us we've got to walk away. And since all of the major funders in this space, I think, tend to sympathize with the people with the progressive talking points, what you have seen is that the national professional organizations looking increasingly blue, even as the dynamics are very different in states and communities.
That's such a fantastic point. You know, as you're talking, Rick, I'm thinking about John Walton. And John Walton was the founder, really, of the Walton Family Foundation. He was writing checks from that foundation before there was really more than one or two paid staff members. And, yeah, a lot of people are out there and they'll say, I knew John Walton and, you know, you're no John Walton. Well, I knew John Walton and I keep thinking he'd not really be happy, because what he would say was, first of all, most people don't even know what his politics were. I don't even know, you know, if we'd know today. But he literally would go work with or find people who reflected the communities that he was trying to support. If that was in an urban Washington, D.C., it might be somebody like Virginia Walden Ford, who was a pioneer here. If it was Milwaukee, of course, he was very good friends with Howard Fuller. He would find the African-American community leaders. If it was a suburb, he'd say, what do those moms want? And what should we do? And that's how he launched this foundation, which I do think was very open to funding conservatives, even though I'd argue he probably was not. And so you call the Walton Foundation very conservative, but I kind of go, are they? Because most of their leadership are not. And so if kind of like back in the day when, you know, the arguments about philanthropy, Carnegie and Ford and all these great capitalists ended up creating foundations that were anything but, are we seeing a change in staff driving things maybe because of who they are that doesn't reflect the founders?
Well, it's a good question, and we don't know the answer, to tell the truth. And to be clear, we don't call the Walton Family Foundation conservative, but we quote a number of people who do, just to reveal how misunderstood.
Got it.
The partisan composition of the Walton and Gates grantees are. Now, as to, you know, whether this is the strategy that John Walton would have done had he survived and lived longer, it's unclear. It feels dramatically different than the strategy when he was alive. And we believe that the composition is of the partisan composition of the movement is also quite different than when he was alive. Now, how it came to change is unclear, and it's possible that it was just circumstances or other forces that produced it, or it could be preferences or relationships of people who work in these organizations.
And it could be that the more a movement becomes an industry, right, it sort of loses its touch with what came before and what it was. I mean, I have to imagine that the boardrooms of these foundations and other places must be looking at the damning comment that the NEA gives a larger slice of its campaign contributions to Republicans than to employees of Gates. I mean, wow.
Although we joke to each other that it's possible that people looking at this result will say, hooray, we've done it. We managed to produce a more thoroughly democratic partisan movement, and that was our goal, and we did it. So we don't know whether this is a discomforting finding or not to people.
That's a great point, because as you said earlier, they have tried very hard to, many people have tried very hard, as we all have, to make sure this was about the issue first and politics next. You make this great comment about unencumbered by Republicans in their midst, school reformers have found themselves energetically embracing progressive stances on hot button issues such as immigration, tax policy and gun control. I remember last year, the year before, hearing that the KIPP leadership was in town lobbying about DACA. And I thought, OK, I understand you're for kids. This may be how you feel. But that's a striking thing. And then I've been at summits with some of these other networks where, as we've all talked about, there's many of the common things happening out in the world that have nothing really to do with education, but those become spotlight issues.
Yeah. No, and it's really interesting. I mean, I think we've all seen that the public response has mostly been, twofold. Either Rick and Jay are wrong. I know Republicans. Some of my best friends are Republicans. Their data must be crazy. Or, of course, we don't work with Republicans. Republicans are a bunch of evil cowards who hate children in cities and in Appalachia, and Republicans don't want to help them. So there's been that response. But the funny thing is the number of private notes I think we've gotten from people who said, guys, thanks for saying that. Partly because it's interesting. I think in these boardrooms and in these organizations, there are thoughtful, reasonable people who, even if they are themselves deeply progressive, they know that moving that changing schools in most states requires red and blue working together. Mm-hmm. It requires suburbanites and urban leaders. It requires not just winning a vote, but being able to hold the line 2 years out, 4 years out. And so these are folks who understand how hard the dynamics of this blue dynamic has made it for them to actually drive real change, and how it has helped to blow up some of their pet ideas like Common Core, like teacher evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
But these folks, I think, are frequently nervous about saying any of that too loudly because they don't want to get crosswise with their friends. They don't want to be flagged as somebody who's an apologist for Trump. And so I think a lot of these groups are having real difficulty having honest conversations about how do they get themselves out of this box that they're in.
Well, and then I just think about the other parallel universe out there where we talk a lot on this show about the unions, the Red for Ed. The opponents are emboldened, right? They're not feeling nearly as challenged as they used to feel challenged. It's almost like we've muted the horror and the anger at the state of education that seems to allow us to stand back. I mean, conversations that I've had with people who refuse to go after this behavior is actually stunning compared to where it was. So I'm wondering if that also is linked somehow, where we don't want to criticize or challenge people whose views we might believe on other levels, particularly with presidential elections around the corner.
I think that's a fair point, that it may be that some views that are actually obstacles to reform are not being challenged because people sympathize with either those views or those people on other issues. But we also have situations out there, a lot of situations where the state representatives of national advocacy organizations find themselves pushing policies and reform ideas that are extremely unpopular within their states, but they feel like they have to because those are the priorities of the national organization they work for. I mean, I was out in Georgia meeting with a group of local representatives of national organizations, and they were pushing things that were clearly unpopular within Georgia. I pointed out that they had a Republican governor and both chambers strongly held by Republicans. Why didn't they push something that Republicans would like? And they said, well, that's not what the national organization tells us to do. So this is part of the problem, is that we're also not able to come up with a diversity of possible reform solutions that might work in different contexts, or both politically and educationally. We're not able to explore that diversity, and instead we're afflicted with a groupthink that is really hurting the movement overall.
Two very concrete instances, Jeannie, of what Jay's talking about that come to my mind. One is the head of an outfit called Stand for Children, co-authored, as you'll recall, an op-ed with the head of the American Federation of Teachers, in which he lined up with the teachers' unions bashing vouchers, mm-hmm. In order to try to score some quick political points. I think national ed reform is at a point where a lot of these folks would much rather line up with the unions and sell off parts of the reform agenda rather than be stuck standing with Republicans. Mm-hmm. A second is when former Secretary of Education Ernie Duncan had a sit-down with charter leaders back in early in 2017, when the Trump administration and Betsy DeVos were talking about trying to increase federal funding for charters, Duncan told them, hey, that would be blood money. It is important that you guys go and tell them that we don't want their dollars for charters because it's going to come at the expense of other schools. The fact that he would feel comfortable saying this to a nominally bipartisan group and tell them that federal support for charter schoolings is blood money, I think tells you everything you need to know about the dynamics at work in a lot of
right, which is why people from, again, Milwaukee to Chicago to Kentucky who don't have great schools wonder why we could say that about anyone's money when it's going to actually help kids. And that used to be it. Again, I mentioned Howard Fuller before. You guys know him. You know, he's been on this show. Actually, he was my inaugural guest some 53 episodes ago, if anyone wants to go listen. But he would get yelled at for taking right-wing money. Howard is anything but a Republican. And he would say, I will take money from anyone who wants to help me help my kids. And that should be the attitude, whether it's with money or activity. And that is that does seem to be the crux of the problem. Okay, so one final question. What do we do about this? Okay, I know you said that maybe this is just to be out there. Maybe there's nothing to do. But what have you heard that people want to do about it? Or what would you recommend to others who want to pursue this?
It's not obvious to me that something will be done about it. I haven't heard much in the way of people saying that something concrete ought to be done. The most positive feedback has been we really ought to try to improve bipartisanship, but I haven't really heard very many specific proposals on that. I don't know if you've heard differently, Rick.
And I think for me, I think two things. One, I would encourage conservative funders and staff at conservative foundations to stop putting money into groups that ridicule and dismiss conservative views and values. If they can't find groups that respect their views and values that want their funds, they should try to find somebody to start such groups. The second thing is I would think that some of the – I know that some of the 200-plus groups in the sample that Jay and I looked at make strong claims about being centrist and bipartisan and looking left and right for good ideas and allies. And I would like to see more of them make more of an effort to live up to these aspirations. So that's two things.
Great advice. And as you know, I have often said this about my organization, which I'm very proud of. When we go through the entire board and the list of our team, we're 50-50. And so maybe that's unique. I don't know. And it's not just to toot the horn of CER, even though this is my show and I can say anything I want. But at the point I'm making is, we've always looked for people who put the issue first, and in doing so, we tend to have found this really interesting, strange bedfellows that we only find out after a board meeting or cocktails. So I think you guys have done a tremendous service to the cause for kids, and particularly anyone listening out there who has families or children that you are concerned about and you're wondering why people aren't helping you as much anymore. This could be at the heart of that, because there's just not enough people focused on who you are. They might be focused on kind of what you are first. So with that, I want to thank Rick Hess and Jay Green, my guests today on Reality Check. You can read their latest report, and I hope you do, entitled Education Reform's Deep Blue Hue, at educationnext.org. Follow them on Twitter. Oh, my gosh, fascinating Twitter conversations going on about this and lots of other thing. At Rick Hess 99 and at JP Green. And, of course, follow me at Jeannie Allen. And tune in next week for another episode of Reality Check. Thank you so much, Rick and Jay.
Hey, thanks, Jeannie.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Reality Check. You can subscribe to Reality Check at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn, and never miss an episode. Visit us online at edreform.com and follow CER on Twitter at edreform and me, Jeannie Allen. I look forward to exploring the world of education with you and another prominent guest next time. See you then.